Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. Hey, Nerdist Podcast listener, do you live in a city? We might be coming to that city. January 28th, we'll be in San Francisco doing the Nerdist Podcast live as part of SF Sketchfest. March 2nd, Boulder. March 3rd, Austin, Texas. March 23rd, Philadelphia. March 24th, Atlanta. March 30th, Minneapolis. April 12th, Madison, Wisconsin. April 13th, Chicago, Illinois. April 14th, Iowa City, Iowa. And more dates are going to be added soon, so check out nerdist.com/calendar to get information and tickets on all of those shows.
Do you have domains that you want to register, or are you with a company that maybe has pissed you off in some way? Well, then take your domain business over to Hover.com. Hover is domain registration and service that is simple. You can actually call Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. There's a no-hold policy for customer service. You actually get a live person. They will talk to you, walk you through, which you probably won't even need because their UI is so clean and simple. The registering domains is a snap. You can set up email addresses, forward email addresses, redirect domains to other websites, create URL extensions, set privacy controls, and it is literally just a few clicks. So if you need any domain business at all, please go to hover.com. They've been an amazing sponsor of the Nerdist Podcast for quite a while now. That's hover.com/Nerdist and use the offer code Nerdist to get 10% off your domain registration. I thank them for their continued support of our wee podcast. And now the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 156 with David Cross. And after listening to this podcast, be sure to check out the new season of David's show, The Increasingly Poor Decisions of Todd Margaret. The season premiere is January 6th. That's Friday. It's 10:30, 9 Central on IFC. And now here's the podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Talked a lot about Twilight Zone because he had like tons of crazy Twilight Zone props, like even like a credit plate, like with the background on it that they actually use.
His fandom of the show, or is he doing?
He's just a huge fan.
Yeah.
David Cross, it's nice to see you. We're recording the podcast now.
All right.
That was the official start.
We just kind of stumble into it.
We just fall into it, like we just got home from an all nighter. And we're just in the midst of it. Do you live in LA now? What's going on?
No. I still live in New York, or based out of New York. I haven't been there too much in the last couple of years. But also my girlfriend lives here, she lives with me in New York, but also has a place here. So coming here is quite easy. It's not like I'm coming to a place where I have to get a hotel room or crash at somebody's house or get a sublet or something like that. So it's, so I'm here more often than I normally would for somebody who doesn't care for LA.
Wait, so I'm unclear on this. You do not like Los Angeles?
I don't, I'm not one of those,
I hate LA, LA sucks.
And I lived here for 9.5 years and you find enjoyable things about it, which there are many. But I much prefer New York to L.A., I guess, put it that way.
But you don't live in the city anymore, right? Don't you live, like, upstate New York?
I have a place upstate, and I spend way more time than I ever imagined I would up there. I have to be in the city for either if I'm doing sets or whatever work there is. My place, I don't know that many people up there. It's a very, very, very small town.
It's just nice to have.
Oh, it's great. I'm there way, I thought it would be kind of a weekend thing occasionally, but I'll go up there and say for 4 days and four turns into six, turns into eight. And it's great. It's one of the best decisions I ever made.
Nice.
It's almost kind of like how Zach bought a place in North Carolina and then just spends as much time there as possible.
Yeah, farm.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I have friends, other friends who live in the city, and also some people I've met since I've been up there, who have places around, maybe not necessarily down the street, but a surprising amount for such a small town in the middle of nowhere in Sullivan County, you know, and who are up there quite a bit, you know, and yeah.
How far away is it from the city? Like how long?
It's 2 hours and change, depending on traffic. It's I've made it door to door. I'm in the East Village and door to door in 2 hours at the, you know, at its best. And I guess at its worst, not excluding something like Hurricane Irene, something like that, it'd be 2.5 hours. There's two places where there's traffic. One is the FDR going over the George Washington Bridge in the city. And the other is the last half hour is on a one-lane, tiny, winding road. And if you get behind, you know, a truck or something or some guy, and you just can't pass for 15 minutes will go by.
Did you have to make the Irene evacuation?
No, I was actually upstate and stayed there. And then going... But going back home, like 2 days later, all of this big chunk of 87 was shut down. So I had to loop through New Jersey, and it took 4 hours. Nice. I had to go off of the main, like go out of the state and go approach it from another state.
You know? With all of the weird differences between New York and Los Angeles, have you thought about writing with comedy? Have you thought about really devoting a lot of stand-up to the differences between these two disparate cities?
Well, I have a humorous T-shirt line. And
is it with these T-shirts that Bryce Kapanz was wearing?
They're all accompanied by Cheech and Chong candles. I was able to buy a ton of Cheech and Chong candles.
How do you get those? And, that's amazing.
It's online.
Make your own Cheech and Chong candles?
No, I mean,
there are licensed products out there, Jonah.
Yeah, there's 600,000 units, and I got them. I was watching Storage Wars and bid on a locker.
We talked about that earlier.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, maybe that's why I'm a little hesitant to
go into it,
just because it is so trite and kind of cliche.
That's fine. We could just talk about men and women then.
You know, they always go to the bathroom in groups, I hear.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking black and white.
Oh, me too. Yeah. I meant black people.
Can I say I've made an observation that... black people are from Mars and white people are from the planet Earth.
I mean, there's your book title right there.
There it is. But you have to have the intonation.
It's audiobook only because you have to. Yeah. Oh, I want to hear. I haven't heard. I want to listen to your audiobook because you just completely fucked around with it.
I did. Well, I did to make it a little different. Like, and I've tried to do that with most stuff I put out, like a DVD of a concert is different than the CD portion and vice versa for all those things I did. But so the audio version of the book, like I had a lot of people do this. This isn't unique, but I had, you know, John Benjamin and Kristen Schaal and different people do different things in it. I also had Lasave Fav just take over a section and just start singing what was basically a six-page list of things. Yeah.
Long song. Yeah, it was great.
Yola Tango does backing music for one of the stories I read. And then one thing that I would have to go back, because I haven't heard it, but I've had a number of people. When I say number of people, I mean like 100 people personally say this, and then people wrote in, you know, on my Facebook page, and who were legitimately angry. Not angry, I'm going to punch you, but really like, hey, man, what the fuck kind of attitude. Like, I thought that was bullshit because there were various times where I would say,
oh, yeah.
And I don't know how many, I'm like 3 or 4, maybe like I'd be reading it and then I'd stop and go, why are you listening to this? It's so lazy. Just get the book, read. What happened to reading?
I think it was more than 3 times.
I don't know. Yeah. I'd have to listen to it.
Yeah. Were you one of the 100
people? I like doing both though. That's the thing. Like I got the book, but then I also got the audiobook.
But I'm not really serious when I go, you're losers for listening to this. I mean, I was fucking around.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, it was great.
Do you feel
like that because of your presentation and because your delivery is very sort of matter of fact when you're talking on stage? And do you find that in your head, if someone's not getting it, you're like, you really think I'm serious about this? Does that ever piss you off?
Oh, I mean, I'll say it. Even if you sense it, because sometimes you can sense it, and certainly, it's an evolution from when I started before anybody knew who I was, where I wanted them to believe. I was fine with people hating me or walking out or complaining. Then I was doing my job, you know, where I wanted people to think that I was deadly serious about this absurd thing that I was saying or false anger. But now it's a little trickier because people know me, and if they think I'm seriously upset with them, then that's not necessarily a good thing. There'll be less people to get upset with next time.
Did you start in New York or San Francisco, or was it neither?
Boston. Right?
I always think of you as like Atlanta. Coming down from the. Mm. You're right.
Atlanta.
But I guess in my comedy history, because I came into the I started watching the sort of that whole scene in like 91 or 2, I think, mm-hmm. like right around when everyone migrated to Luna Lounge or wherever it was.
Right.
And so I just assume like, oh, you came down from San Francisco with like Barrett and all those guys.
No, I mean, as water seeks its own level, we all knew each other just from mutual friends and things like that. And I started in Atlanta, but then that was the rawest start you can imagine. I was 17, 18 years old. Wasn't very good. Hadn't really found my voice, and wouldn't for a few years. But that was the first place I did shows. First place I did stand up. First place I did goofy things with my friends at some music club, stuff like that. But I don't. I mean, that's just the bare essence, organic start. Where I really kind of came into my own was Boston. I moved to Boston when I was 19. And that's where I met, you know, Louis C.K., Janine, Lord Keitlinger, Marin, you know, all the guys you know of, and obviously many others that you don't. Look at that guy.
Oh, man. Well,
I wish I had gotten a quick picture of that.
That's a pastel green sweatshirt underneath
pink.
I'm going to say shrimp colored.
And, sandals with socks on.
Is he
with them, I assume.
Is he gay or just foreign?
Foreign.
He's a foreign gay.
Wow. He's so confused.
Is it Ferengi?
Ferengi.
Well played.
We're all about profit.
But yeah, Boston's where I really kind of came into my own and developed my voice. And
that's fascinating to me because I always think of Boston comics as like more, not shouty, but really just like fucking grabbing the audience by the scruff and being like, here are jokes.
That's why this whole notion of alternative comedy, even before there was a name or a label for it, because that didn't really come around till we were in New York and L.A., you know, mm-hmm. in the early 90s. But to use the true definition of the word, that stuff that we were doing, all the people I mentioned, and there are dozens more, you know, that was truly an alternative to exactly what you're describing, which was 90% of Boston comedy, which was shouty and there's kind of a macho braggadocio.
Yeah.
And I hopefully you'll start using that word braggadocio.
Braggadocio.
Yeah. And there was that, you know, that
Vinny Braggadocio.
There was the swagger. It was very sexist. There was subtle and not so subtle racism to it.
It wasn't
and
subtle. It was never subtle.
You know, it was loud. It was confrontational, and you know, people loved it. And then we had one or two. We had Catch a Rising Star in Cambridge, and then occasionally you'd have like Stitches or
where
Sam's.
Was that? Where was Catch a Rising Star in Cambridge?
Right in Harvard Square. It's now I don't know what it is now, but it turned into a Buck a Book.
Oh, I think it's still a Buck a Book. It's still a Buck a Book. That was just for me, everybody.
Yeah, it was. But that was the you know, or you'd do your own shows. We had like John Ennis, who was on Mr. Show, would kind of started this whole thing of doing shows in loft spaces, like friends' lofts in South Boston and stuff.
I remember John Ennis from a Young Comedian special that Joe Piscopo hosted, and they totally put John Ennis on the spot. And Joe Piscopo was like, "Hey, I heard you do a Joe Piscopo impersonation." And he was just kind of shitty to him and sort of put him on the spot to do his Joe Piscopo in front of Joe Piscopo.
Yeah.
Now no one's really doing Joe Piscopo impersonations anymore. Yeah. Was it weird? I always wonder because when I look at your guys' the comedy movement that I sort of, I mean, that was the comedy movement I most identified with. And if you guys were in the senior class, I was like freshman, sophomore class.
About like the Luna Lounge.
Yeah, exactly. I came in a handful of years. I came in a handful of years later. But I always looked at it as sort of, I don't know how else to describe it, like a punk comedy movement, because it's sort of the antithesis of what else was going on.
Yeah, or alternative.
Alternative,
you know,
yeah.
You know, I mean, that's why that eventually it became nationalized. I mean, it wasn't, as you were saying before, San Francisco had their kind of comic, and then there was an alternative to that. And there were all the folks who came out of San Francisco who migrated down to L.A. So now Boston and San Francisco are now seeping in and then eventually taking over New York and L.A. And, you know, by the time, when there was Surf Reality and, I mean, there were about five clubs in New York that, you know, you could go to an alternative comedy show. Mm-hmm. It was before it had its name, and same with L.A., Big and Tall Bookstore, and eventually on Cabaret and things like that. And now it's all, I mean, it's all, they all bleed into one another, and it's all firmly established, and there's no such thing as alternative to that anymore.
Do you find it's kind of hard to present, when a lot of the earlier stuff is kind of about just like fucking, like showing your asshole at the system, and then all of a sudden you become successful. Like, is that weird? Is success weird?
I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who all of a sudden became successful.
Not all of a sudden, but I mean,
it was a.
But I mean,
for most of us, it was kind of a long slog. Not hard, but it was so, which I wouldn't trade for anything. You know, there was no kind of overnight thing. There were many steps taken, and. Each of those steps is valuable because you learn more and you're making new friends, new contacts, and potentially new people you're going to work with, you know, in the future.
And do you do a lot of sets now in New York? Because you're in LA, but I haven't heard that you're performing anywhere.
I've done a couple of, a handful of things here and there, one benefit, one, and I did Eugene Merman's, 5th anniversary show at the Bell House in Brooklyn and a Kurt and Kristen show. And outside of that, those are the first three shows I've done since, really since doing my last set on the tour that I did 2.5 years ago.
Wow.
Or maybe it's 3 years. No, 2 years now. But I've been in London doing Todd Margaret. Mm-hmm. So, and not that there's an opportunity to do sets there. And I used to do sets there a lot before, but this is the second time it's, I guess I'll phrase it as happened to me, but I just don't have any material. My head isn't, and I've been trying, and I'm like, all right, I gotta, and I don't have the skills or the capability to focus and try to, almost like, I guess, filter my comedy sensibilities into three things. And right now I'm thinking of other things in terms of story for this TV idea. And I need to kind of say, okay, I'm going to look at things like a stand-up. And the weird thing I notice, like, how does that translate? How am I going to talk about that on stage as opposed to, oh, that'd be a good idea for this thing I'm working on.
Right,
I could have a character do this and that. And I've literally written two jokes in the last 2 years. And I don't write really, or I should say I've thought of two jokes have occurred to me.
Right.
outside of one thing that sort of writes itself, which was I was in London and I saw a guy, this is for real, I saw a guy wearing the most impractical t-shirt you could imagine. It was in big, shiny letters, and it said, I'm in Miami, bitch. And so you can have fun with that, but that's like that's not really writing comedy, you know. Well, yeah. Telling you about this ridiculous.
Do you feel like
t-shirt.
You're just so focused on work and other stuff that you're not in situations anymore where you're kind of just free to react to stuff?
No, I don't really have any kind of excuse. It's not that. It's because, you know, a lot of the stuff, my comedy has become more personal over the years, and more kind of autobiographical as opposed to what it used to be like. And you know, I could, things are going to happen to you, whether you're sitting in an editing suite or at dinner somewhere. You're always going to have dinner. You're always going to be going from point A to point B and observing things. And whether you're on in your car in LA or on the tube in London or on your bike in New York, you're still going to interact with people. And I just haven't been thinking in that way, and I need to kind of retrain myself to start thinking that way. Because well, I do want to do it. I love doing stand-up. It's just, and I had this happen roughly 8-9 years ago, same thing, where I just had a dry period for a good couple years where it just wasn't happening. My brain wasn't working that way, and I'm looking to kind of jumpstart it and get back to, and I even, you know, as I said, I did those three shows, and each time I'd go up there going, I got nothing, I'm hoping this works, I'm just going to try to ramble for 10 minutes, I hope you know, don't mind indulging me, maybe some gem will come out, and not a whole lot came out. I mean, I talked, each show I had I showed a slideshow from one of the worst weeks I've ever spent in my life. I had to go on a cruise ship for a week, and it was it's a long story, and it was just awful. It was really depressing and infuriating and sad, and I've been talking about that, and I have a slideshow that accompanies it with pictures I took, and people seem to be into that, but that almost feels like a performance piece thing.
Did you really stand? Did you had to work on a cruise, or you had to go on a cruise?
I had to work on a cruise.
Ugh.
It was awful. It was just, and here's the thing: I didn't really have to. I was made to. I was working on a movie. You'll see it in a matter of days.
They go to an island now.
Yeah, they do. A couple of the cast members end up getting shipwrecked. it was honestly in my professional career the most miserable I've been, and the most poorly I've been treated and disrespected. And I did not have to go on this cruise ship, and they made me go. And it was in the middle of Todd Margaret. I had to come from London. And I was threatened with being sued, and it was just an awful, awful experience. And for a number of reasons, and
you had to peel the shrimp. It was terrible.
Is that a euphemism?
Yeah.
And I, so that is separate though from the actual having to be on a cruise ship. And when I say be on it, I left once. No, that's not true. I left twice. So there was a. But one time I left for about 20 minutes maybe, and then the other I was able to get out for about half a day. Outside of that, you are locked, trapped into this, just the worst of American ideals, the worst of what we are as a country.
Floating Vegas.
But not Vegas. It's a floating Shreveport, Louisiana. It's not Vegas. If it was Vegas, there's other things for people like us that we could enjoy. But there'd
be a bar at the bottom called the Double Down that you could go to.
There is nothing on, and it's very
it's
small,
like
it's very tight, compact. It's faux everything, And a lot of I've met a lot of cool people, and I don't want to kind of paint this broad brushstroke of everybody, because I there was like a poker table, and I would play Texas Hold'em with roughly the same 12-15 handful of rotating folks in there, and they were all really great. Most of them were. And but just some, I have this level of celebrity. It might, you know, Mark Rivers.
Yeah, yeah, very well.
Mark, one time we were out.
Did the theme show for theme song for Mr. Show?
Yes, yeah. amongst many, other many other things. Yeah. And he said, he was like, "Dude, you need to either get more famous or less famous, because the level you're at." There is no respect. People feel fine coming over going, "Hey," just right interrupting your dinner with whatever, you're on the phone. "Hey, you're what are you on? You're famous, right? What's the thing you're on?" And
that is the side effect of being on television versus being a movie star, where people are afraid to go up. But on television, it's like, "Hey, this fucking guy's in my living room every night. I can talk to the guy. Hey, what was that? I don't watch television, but what was that thing you're on?"
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, what was that thing, the story Posehn had, where he was like in Vegas, and a guy like went up to him and just started poking. He's like, "I'm being irritating, like you are on TV."
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my
Jesus.
God. Yeah. Why do people think that's okay?
I don't understand.
my favorite is the... And by favorite, I mean least favorite, is the guy or woman, it's mostly a guy, 9 out of 10 times, who does the fake, like, "Listen, I don't know who you are, but my girlfriend says you're famous," and, you know, who comes over, like, with this kind of apologetic, half apologetic, and like...
No real reason to come up at all.
No real reason at all. "And where's your girlfriend? Where is she?"
Yeah.
You're pointing to a corner. I see 150 people there. "You know, she said you're famous, and like I don't give a shit. I don't watch TV, but anyway, she said, so what do you do? Who are you?"
Now, what's funny about that, and particularly with actors and comics, is that a lot of performers are relatively uncomfortable one-on-one with strangers. So to have someone confront them in that way, and to come up and be like, "Hey, what are you?" You're just instantly like, "Why are you talking at me?"
Yeah, but I say those things to give you a context for being on this claustrophobic cruise ship with literally thousands. It was the California Dream, the Carnival Dream, which at the time was the largest pleasure cruise ship on the planet.
You know what the Carnival Dream is.
Yeah. Now you do. And it's really tight spaces, claustrophobic, and
you gotta spend the extra money to get the balcony, otherwise you'll just kill yourself.
It was 7 days of... I stayed in my tiny little room. It was teeny tiny, if you've ever seen a picture of those things, where like the toilet is next to the sink, next to the shower, it's all one thing. Mm-hmm. And you walk in and your bed's right there, there's a little monitor and a... kind of desk dresser thing that sticks out of the wall, and then the wall, and it's just that. And I spent most of my time in there. It was just because you'd walk around and people were like, "Hey, it's Chick Bop Bye Guy," "Hey," or "Hey, Alvin the Chipmunks, hey, get over here, Uncle Ian,"
"get over here."
and also to kind of justify my whining about this, the scenes that they wanted me to there for. There were three scenes. My character in the beginning of the movie, is certainly the part that takes place on the cruise ship, is in a mascot uniform, like a foam rubber cruise ship mascot uniform. Not an inch of flesh is showing. Nothing. And here's the kicker. Ready for this? No dialogue.
Oh.
No dialogue. You can't see me.
Now, I'm surprised you didn't get a better stateroom.
Jesus Christ.
I'm surprised you didn't get a better stateroom.
There, I don't know if there are better ones, really. They're renownedly cheap, this studio, and they're infamously, you know, many people complain, but they were sticking the wardrobe people, three people to a room. When I say it's tiny, I mean, go look on the website.
They're very small rooms.
Have you been on a cruise?
I mean, nothing. Yeah. There's no room. I can't imagine. I mean, it was tough for one person. I can't imagine three. And the amount of obese people, that's what was truly, like, how are they getting in and out of that room?
The buffets that bring them in.
But how the room itself, like
you have to grease up and then you grease through the.
I don't know how they do it.
The toilet has got to be particularly difficult.
Oh man!
I remember. Well, I want to talk a little bit about Mr. Show, but I do want to thank you because
you're welcome.
I want to thank you for Mr. Show. Thank you. I actually do want to thank you for Mr. Show, but
you're welcome.
But before that, I do want to say. September 1st or 2nd of 2001, we're all at Bumbershoot, having a good time, not giving a shit about anything, not going through crazy security at airports. We all go back to New York. September 10th, I was with you.
Oh my God.
We were out until like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Really? I remember that. That was the opening of Luna.
Yes.
That was the first night of that
The Luna
season.
Lounge, yeah,
and
in East Village.
I hosted it, yeah.
Yep, which was a great Monday night comedy show in New York. And, and I barely slept because I was supposed to get on a plane the next morning to fly back to LA. And then September 11th happened. And then it just felt like, even that day, it felt like the night before where we didn't give a fuck about anything and we were up all night drinking. It felt like it was 6 months ago.
Oh, man, I couldn't even. I just remember the particulars. I don't remember the night so much. I remember getting really hammered. And we all had a good time. And I met that girl, whatever, but we were all running around and it was a really, and it also there was that spirit of like, hey, Luna Lounge, you know, the season's back or whatever. Yeah. It's gonna be great
because it takes there's a lot of comedy takes off for the summer in New York, and then in the fall it starts back up and people are into the groove again.
Yeah, and it was literally the first night back of the Luna nights and yeah, I think we went to Max Fish. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, went to Max Fish.
I remember playing a pinball machine somewhere.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that's okay. Max Fish. All right.
So, but we had a great time, and then that happened, and then I sort of got I sort of got stuck in New York because I didn't want to travel back and forth. And then you actually called me. I think it was that day or the next day to make sure I was okay, and I always thought that was really nice, you know, because I knew you from. You worked on Trashed, which was my very first job at MTV.
It was going way back.
1994.
Well, that would have been one of the first things I did, too. I came out to L.A. for Stiller, but after that, that was probably the very next thing I did.
Oh,
was
wow.
Did stuff on Trash, yeah.
Oh, the Stiller show. Oh, my God, the Stiller show. I took a tape from MTV that just said, like, the best of the Ben Stiller show. It was just a VHS tape that I took in the late 90s.
VHS
and it was
tapes.
Every fucking... it was an amazing collection. I mean, I wore that tape into the ground, just like every Manson and Kate Munster and just every fucking
TGA Fridays.
TJ O'Pooter Toots.
TJ O'Pooter Toots. Yeah.
I had forgotten that you wrote on that show, and then we're on that show.
Sketch. Towards the end, I was
Dave with a big bunch of curly hair.
Yeah, pretty baldy. Yeah, and then I think Trash was probably, I would imagine, literally the next thing I did was we just came in and did those little vignettes.
Yeah.
Was Steve Higgins writing on it?
Steve Higgins was the head writer for that.
Yeah.
And actually, so was Dave Higgins, was a writer, and then he left to be on the Ellen sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gruber, and then Joel Hodgson and Odenkirk did stuff, and Dana Gould and Margaret Cho and Janine. It was a fun group of people.
It was fun. Yeah.
And then so that sort of felt like Mr. Show kind of redefined how a comedy show, I think, could be done. And I would see that for years later because it's a good format where you're on stage sort of, you know, like in the midst of a conversation. And then that kind of that throws into a sketch.
Right. Right. I mean, that was a calculated thing we did. It was a conscious effort to do that. But also clearly... taken from Monty Python, that idea of the although they you can't really tell they did their shows live, or they did, you know, it looks live, it looks like they're
right.
But you never see their audience or anything, you kind of hear them sometimes, and we wanted to make the audience kind of a part of the show, you know that's why we'd walk through the audience or start the intro with a camera going. You know, there's a person who represents a character that's going to be in the show, and then the camera goes past the audience, and then, you know, we talk directly to them and stuff. And that was a conscious thing we did.
Did they bring in, did they bus in just random audience people, or did you actually, know what the fuck they were seeing?
No, the first season, quote unquote, were just four episodes, very experimental, very low budget. We shot it at one of those spaces that you can rent on one of those side streets between Hollywood and Sunset, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was a place that had, there's a point where I turn the camera and point to
the TV.
I point to the menu, and it's, that's real.
We just coffee left shop. That up. Yeah.
Wait, was it at,
it started with an L, I think.
Wasn't it at like near, next to the Tamron Theater? Wasn't it like over there?
I don't know where that is.
That was the UCB now.
So that's La Poubelle.
No. This was literally a side street off of Hollywood, and on that Hollywood strip before they redid it, and before the Kodak Theater and all that crap.
Oh, I think I might.
It was a tiny street, whatever. Yeah. It wasn't Las Palmas, but it was somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And you know, you could literally hear crickets that were in the walls. And the audience was bussed in, and there was this moment there where, you know, because we got very good at eventually winnowing down the time between takes and between setups and stuff, because we wanted the show to move quickly, because we had, you know, video pieces that would roll in and we'd have to set up, you know, the next set and stage and all that stuff. But in the first four episodes, we didn't have, really didn't have it down yet. And so I'm sitting on stage waiting to get the camera set, and these kids were bussed in from like Eagle Rock, and I'm like, hey, what do you guys think of the show? And they're like Hispanic seniors in high school, and he's like, y'all needs more color, man. And they were right, we had no color at all.
That's when Jerry Minor was hired.
Yes, get us Jerry Minor.
Oh, adding color to your show, I see.
But yeah, it was high school kids from Eagle Rock for the first four episodes. And we had some of our friends, you know, people who knew us. And we had done, Bob and I had done at least five, if not six, seven kind of variations of Mr. Show in places live before it was a TV show, before we conceived of it as a TV show. So there were folks who knew us from there, you know, the comedy community, you guys who would come down. But, you know, they filled out that audience with... You know, not really our crowd.
No.
But that show really
they
was
just left the Drew Carey show. Here, no, come to this.
This is pre Carlos Mencia, so they had nowhere to go. They're wandering around waiting for Carlos Mencia to get a show.
But when is this gonna happen?
Yeah.
Finally.
I gotta leave.
That show you have to go to work?
I have to go shoot B-roll.
Ah shit.
Hey.
Matt's producing a gadget segment that we're shooting today, so you have to go shoot B-roll for the computers.
I don't care.
Yeah, I know. Honestly, I don't either.
I think
I do.
All right. Bye, Matt Meyer. I'll see you in a couple hours.
We're on time, Chris. I could have shared the whole thing.
Yeah, snap. Oh, it was my fault. No, I'll take that.
Good thing you weren't on time.
I'll take that punch in the fucking nose.
But you have a great excuse. If there's an excuse for you to be late and keep me waiting for half an hour, it's that J.J. Abrams wanted to keep talking. I'd do the same to you.
He was...
sorry, guys. J.J. Abrams.
He was fucking amazing. It was really great.
That guy's amazing.
But the Mr. Show was really sort of... That's when that kind of comedy movement really solidified. It was something that was totally different and really spoke to people who just needed something other than this, you know, than what was being offered on television at the time.
And it became an employer for so many people too. I know you're speaking of comedy fans outside of the LA universe.
Yeah.
But you know, we also, when you look at the 33 episodes we did over those 4 years, I mean, we worked with a lot of great, you know, cool people, and we're able to give people jobs and stuff.
Pretty much most of the, like, the really smart, cool comedians who have popped in recent years did something or other on Mr. Show at one time.
Those were all our friends. You know, it was very, but that was the scene in LA at that time, you know?
Yeah. And then did you and Bob write together, or did you bring in ideas separately and then kind of go through it with the writer's room?
What was Both, but predominantly it was together. And the way we would approach each year, our writing staff kind of grew little by little, adding one or two or three people each year, adding an extra producer between series two and series three. And then in, season four, I think we had five producers. You know, it was Bob and I and Dino Stamatopoulos and Jay Johnston, which would be four, I guess. But the way it normally worked is Bob and I would meet for anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes informally, and then once we got an office, we'd go in there just on our own, very loosely, you know, not make an entire 8-hour day of it, but, you know, come in at 11, hang out till about 4, and just start writing, you know, and we, the first hour of any day is always like, oh my God, you see 60 Minutes last night? Did you see this thing? Or did you read in the paper this thing? Or, oh my, man, I had this, I got to tell you this story, me and, you know, whoever, we were having dinner, and then this waitress came up, and you just sort of shoot the shit or talk about this idea that you think could be a sketch, and then we just talk, pretty much, just make ourselves laugh and talk about, you know, the thing we read or what we did last night, and then, you know, sometimes you come in with an idea that you thought of, and then we would write. You know, we wrote a bunch of stuff together before the other writers came in, and then it got more, a little more formal.
Right.
And
would you guys have premises for them to script out, or would you guys
sometimes have, but yeah, often people would come in with an idea. We would table stuff. We'd twice a week we'd all meet and go around the room and pitch ideas, and Bob was pretty strict about being respectful to the ideas, and for better or worse, you know, some there were definitely some ideas that were, people were like, what? or an idea or something that somebody had written, and it in immediately didn't, nobody got it or it wasn't funny, but then you go around the room and you add these little tweaks or ideas, and you know, you end up with, maybe it didn't really resemble what it initially was, but you end up with this funny, cool idea. And then vice versa. I remember coming in with the idea for what ended up, I would say, one of our three worst sketches. Not that we didn't try it, and we all kind of believed in it. There was a good idea there, but it just didn't translate, which was... I had this idea that just occurred to me one night, like, oh, you know, it'd be a really great practical joke if you had a party and then you went to your friends individually and said, like, Chris, come here. Hey, man, I'm going to tell everybody I got to go crash. I got to get up early in the morning. But when I do that, you stay here and we'll play, you know, we'll play Call of Duty or whatever the thing. That was the idea for the practical joke, where you have a party of like 20 people and you tell each person or a couple, like, dude, listen, I'm going to go in. You just tell that to everybody, and then you eventually go, all right, well, I got to crash and just watch everybody not leave. Yeah. So that, oh, that's a great idea. We should make that a sketch. And man, we tried so desperately.
It got so big.
And it ended up with this kind of higher concept where it's the queen and like, what is happening? And yeah, it just didn't work. It didn't work. It never really worked. The only good thing about it was some of the performances were funny and the concept was funny, but as a thing, it didn't work. So that's the reverse of that idea that everybody goes, oh, that's great. And it just got worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. Do you find you write from a different place in your head when you're like putting a sketch together versus stand up, or do you feel like it's pretty...
Oh, completely. Absolutely. That's what I was you know, trying to intimate before, was the idea that when I'm thinking in sketch terms, I see things in sketch terms. When I'm thinking in longer arcing TV story ideas, I see the same thing and think of it in those terms, as opposed to when I'm doing stand up and when it you know, it's a very, getting back into it, it's a slow process for me, because I don't write, I don't sit down and right, you know, and yeah. and to my detriment. I'm not saying that's a good thing at all. It's just I'm not a good joke writer, and I never have been, and I don't have the patience or capacity to do it. And most of the writing is kind of done on stage with this kernel of an idea, and I just haven't gotten back into the stand-up mode filter of seeing the same things that I would see that I have been seeing and making that a stand-up bit, as opposed to I'm working on these couple different TV show ideas, and now I'm looking at things like, oh, how can I put that into that? And I need to sort of make a conscious effort, even if it's putting a post-it note on the door before I leave going, remember to think like a stand-up.
when you were writing earlier, when you were writing on the Ben Stiller show and stuff like that, were you still going out and doing stand-up as much?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean,
was that hard to like just, that's the trouble I'm running into now that I'm like writing on shows, is that, you know, being creative for some other entity all day and then having to switch gears for stuff for myself at night.
I think that was the difference, was I was writing for somebody else, so there was not frustration, but there was this, it's not what I would normally be doing. Like, yeah. And specifically with Ben Stiller show, it was often, you know, who does he want to imitate, you know, or what TV parody are we doing? And so it was easy, almost like a release in a way, to go, okay, I did that for 8 hours, and I was trying to, you know, figure out a Tom Cruise thing. And now I want to go out and use my voice, do something that's more me, if yeah. that makes sense. When I'm doing this stuff, especially if I'm writing for a character I'm doing on this TV show idea and this, and trying to come up with this, you know, larger Bible, this story arc for how can this thing last for 3 seasons and where would this character go? And I'm thinking in terms of myself, and that probably impedes that kind yeah. of thing. But when I was writing for somebody else, it was...
So your creative energy wasn't spent at the end of the 8-hour day?
No. It was almost, even if it was, I would just sort of, you leave, you take a breath, you exhale, you put that aside. Okay, I did that. That was my job today. And now, in the next couple hours, and you kind of rejuvenate when you hook up with your stand-up friends and you're yeah. wherever. And then keep in mind, there were also those,
Largo?
Like Largo and Uncabaret.
Or you had to have Largo, your stuff.
Like Uncabaret, where you weren't supposed to do stand-up. So that would...
Oh, yeah. Beth Lapidus would say, don't do... You can't yeah. do... Just bring in a story that happened to you that day, which I think is a cool idea. I think maybe at some point... In some points, though, you're like, well, I mean, a little bit of joke structure is okay. I mean, you know, just because it is a show, you know. Yeah.
But some people ignore that. Like, I know...
People doing their material.
I mean, you know that Dana Gould would go up there, and I love and revere and totally respect Dana Gould, and also who gives a shit about, you know, the parameters that are imposed upon you by somebody else who's running that show. But Dana would often go up and, you know, do some autobiographical thing, and then he'd start doing stand-up. And nobody gave... I'm glad he did. Nobody cared. But a lot of people kind of ignored that, you know... Yeah. That edict from Beth.
Yeah, that all that stuff was totally eye-opening for me and sort of life, because just as someone who was obsessed with comedy my whole life, but then to see it done in that way, I was like, oh my God, I didn't know what I had been missing this whole time.
It was a cool mix of people. Like there were at least every show had somebody that wasn't a stand-up or wasn't necessarily a performer.
You right. know,
which was a smart thing to do.
Yeah. You know? And then I don't know why this always sticks in my head, but I think maybe in 2004 at Bumbershoot, you did a bit about something called Squiggles.
Squiggles from, what was that place called?
Cozy's,
yeah.
Well, they're square bagels.
Yeah. Your grandfather's bagels.
Yes,
they drop on the floor, they roll away. Yeah.
Well, some of that came from, I don't think I showed it, or maybe did I at that show?
I think you showed a flyer or you had something.
Because you would reveal it a little bit.
Here's the thing. I went to, I shot a short film with Sam Cedar for the, like, I can't remember what it was, like a New York.
Who's now a real news
comedy,
guy.
Yeah. New York comedy, you know, something film festival thing that it kind of lasted for like 3 years and then went away. But I shot this little movie for it. And we shot at the cozy corporate headquarters or whatever in, you know, in Midtown somewhere. And we're there. It's a Sunday. There's no security. And that's where I saw the poster. I'm like, are you with this? And then, but even better, and I still have it, is the cozy, I don't know what they call it, but it's, it looks like it's about a 7-minute film. It looks like they might have made for investors, maybe. It has the three guys from, I believe, Washington, D.C. is where they started. And they're talking about the cozy philosophy, right? And they're these kind of guys, kind of just graduated, maybe George Washington, or Georgetown, rather, kind of corporate, you know, Brooks Brothers shirts and, you know, penny loafers. And they're probably like 31, and they're three bros hanging out, good friends. And we wanted to come up with the concept of something that's more than coffee, you know, and it's just bullshit from start to finish. And I used to show that, like, and, you know, I couldn't do it at like big shows, but I would show that around, like, you got to watch this, and I'd stop it. And it's like, what does cozy mean to you? It's, and a lot of Dutch tilt zoom in stuff, the cozy philosophy and all this garbage. But that's where I got that stuff from, was shooting in there, and I was lucky enough to be able to grab some of it and throw it in my backpack.
That was the same bumper shoot that I saw your dick and balls, because there was a knock on my hotel room door, and you and Nick Swardson burst in and started jumping up and down on the bed with no clothes on.
You were one of a number of people. We were going through the hallways. We got naked in the elevator.
Ding dong dicked.
Yeah, totally. Like, completely. No, not even shoes and socks.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And then your clothes were, like, down the hall in a pile, which means that you had to take your clothes off in the hallway.
I think we took them off in the elevator and then threw them down. The idea would be, like, what if somebody's getting on the elevator? And, yeah, because we went into Posehn's room as well, and, yeah. I'm not shy about getting totally naked.
Would you do that now, though, where someone could just, like, take a picture of it and upload it right to Twitter? Would you give a shit?
I did it when Amber and I started going out. She was in New York. She had just moved in with me. And I had met some of her friends for the first time, and we were at Great Jones. And we were all drinking, and this is in the winter, too. She was shooting The Unusuals, and I can't remember how it started, but I did. It was when the 300 movie came out, or was about to come out, and they were incessantly running those commercials like, I am Sparta. And I said it. I don't know why I did it. And then there was a table, and they were kind of joking. Like, they knew who I was, and they're like, that wasn't very good. Yeah, that's not much of a Sparta. And then I took my shirt and sweater off, and then I yelled it in the middle of the restaurant bar again, and they're like, nope, next, or whatever. I was like, oh, yeah? And then I took all my clothes off and just stood there with my dick was next to this guy's face, like, dangling about ear level. And Amber and I had just started going out, basically, like, not too much prior to that, and her friends were there, and they've got plenty of footage and pictures and stuff. That wasn't the last time I got naked. No, it's such a cheap, easy thing. I don't care. I'm not, you know, I'm fairly an open book, and I don't have a large penis, but it's not small. It's not so small I'd be embarrassed.
Right.
It's completely average, and that's fine. I'll take it. And I was at the Groucho in London, which is a...
I've been there.
Yeah, it's kind of a posh, fancy member.
Like,
members.
Upper crust of British performers. Yes.
And we... I can't remember what we had all been doing. We definitely weren't shooting, because I wouldn't get that drunk while we were shooting, but it was for Todd Margaret, and a bunch of us... I can't remember what it is we did, but we were somewhere, and then everybody said, let's go to the Groucho, and I was like, I don't want to go there. It's so... you know, Ponzi and you know, it's just kind of douchey. And let's go to the Phoenix. Have you ever been to the Phoenix in London? I'll tell you about it later. It's awesome.
Okay.
Let's go to the Phoenix. Come on. And I just got outvoted. And so my idea was to get us kicked out of the Groucho. So I took my clothes off. And I did get kicked out, and I ran through the kitchen. That's how I got out of there. And I eventually got my way, and we went to the Phoenix. But that was the last time I got naked.
Nice. How are they freaking out? Are they like, "Sir, you need to leave"?
A more kind of rushed, urgent, "Sir, you need to leave" kind of. They weren't freaking out, but they were not happy with it, and they were very kind of hands-on.
I would think the Brits would think that was hilarious.
Well, some did, but not the guys who worked at the... If you work at the Groucho, you're a certain kind of person.
Right.
You know, to enjoy that kind of thing. And, you know, they don't want some drunk American, quote-unquote, comedian, you know, sitting in a booth. I was sitting in the booth naked. Like, that was my idea, was to just let somebody find me. Like, no. And, I was naked for about 6 seconds before they came running. That was the idea.
Has it been fun to do, or different, just to do Todd Margaret over in London and then ship it back here?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I would vacillate almost, you know, monthly on whether I liked London or not. And it was often, you know, there was periods where it got lonely, you know, and I had a lot of great friends over there. The people I worked with and know there are great. Some of my favorite people in the world. I love them. I wish I could work with them again. But, you know, everybody would eventually go off to their families or girlfriends or boyfriends. And you know, you go back to your flat that's not yours. You're subletting it for somebody else. And you have dinner by yourself. And, you know, I get my Harper's or whatever I was reading and go to the handful of places where people knew me, and you're just there and you eat by yourself, and then you go back and you're by yourself. And
it's like being a comic on the road.
You know? Yeah.
Oddly enough, the weekends were kind of bummer. Like everybody, you'd feel this relief, like, okay, we don't have to, we got a couple days off, but you know, the weekend I just spend by myself, unless I occasionally go to, you know, a football game with somebody or we'd go somewhere, but most of the times you're just hanging out by yourself. But this last year, I had my dog sent over, which is good. And, you know, Amber would come when she could. She was working, and she'd be there for two and a half weeks at a time. And there were maybe two or three times I was able to get away for like 4 days. You know, there's a bank holiday, and, you know, we all decided, like, this, we're kind of ahead on the script or in production, so let's add a day. And so I would go to, you know, the Cornwall or something and see another part of England and, you know, something like that. But for the most part, it's kind of it just got a little lonely. But outside of that, it was, I really, really like London. I like the people there. I like the area I was staying at this last time, which was Notting Hill. It was cool. I like the culture there. I like the I don't mean the culture like a lot of museums and stuff, but the idea that collectively, you know, you work and you know, you leave and you go to a pub, and most everybody goes to a pub and you hang out and you have 1, 2, 3 pints. People don't get trash. I mean, they do on the weekends for sure, but
The pubs close at like 11. Like they're.
Yeah, between 11 and 12. And so you can hang it. There's like a social thing. And often people have a pint at lunch, you know, and everybody would go. The place I worked at was this old warehouse that they turned into this kind of business collective. It would be like this building we're in now was from like 1840 and used to, you know, ship mattresses or something around the world. But they just, you know, redid the interior, and it had its own on-site pub called the Village Fair. Yeah, and you go out there on a nice day, everybody's out there having a pint or a glass of wine or whatever at lunch or two, and then going back to work, and you go back to work till whatever, 6. Then you go to the pub, and especially, you know, if there was, you know, if Liverpool was playing Everton or whatever, you know, there'd be somebody going like, "Oh, mate, go watch that game. And then you'd say, all right, let's go. And you go to the pub down the street. And
yeah, that's why I couldn't handle it. That's why I don't drink anymore, because I would have started at lunch and then just been like, I'll just hang here, you guys.
That's yeah.
I'll just be here till midnight.
I'm bad at just the one at lunch.
But if you wouldn't be, trust me. If you had to work and you had stuff to do, you'd get it done, you know?
There was one time on Web Soup where Blaine Capatch just kept on buying drinks at lunch, and everyone's like, well, Blaine's buying. And then Blaine, of course, is drinking tequila. We're all downing beers. And then we all went back into the little office we shared.
That guy's skinnier than a whippet's tail.
He's tiny. And he eats like shit. We're all going down to like Chipotle. He's like, oh, I don't want that stuff, man. And you see him eating two hot dogs at his desk.
He's a class five mutant. He metabolizes everything at a super high rate.
Oh, I need some Coke.
You can also run really fast.
Then we all went back to the office and we all kind of started, everyone kind of typing a little slower. And then I kind of all of a sudden go, ah! I looked around, and the three of us had all fallen asleep at our desks.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we have a few minutes left with you, but I absolutely have to talk about Arrested Development, which was another one of those. I mean, you've been involved in a lot of shows where they sort of redefine how comedy is presented, and Arrested Development was absolutely one of those shows. Although you remember, you told a funny story at M-Bar one time about how there was a scene where everyone was like eating food, but then everyone had a chum bucket because everyone was on the Atkins diet.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it wasn't everyone. It was the ladies. I know. Yeah, you're right. But that's a great one of those great little Hollywood things where we all had to be eating, and there were a number of people who would just spit it out. Like, really? You don't even have to put that much in your mouth, or there's you can fake swallow some of it and leave the rest of it.
Yeah, I end up doing that though when I fake eat. I end up just going through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I first started, before I knew about Chum Buckets, it was literally the first movie I ever did. Outside of playing reporter number three in the Amelia Earhart story. But I was in a scene where it was there were a bunch of people at a Chinese restaurant, and the food that the art department or props or whatever that was real, that was edible, that came out for us to eat was mushu pork. And that's one of my least favorite Chinese food things. I don't like the hoisin sauce and all that stuff, and I don't like shitty pork. And I didn't even know about the takes and matching takes. And so my character's eating, and I'm rolling up this thing, and I'm taking big bites of it. I ended up having to do that and match it. And eventually, that's how I learned about a chum bucket. Yeah, it's a boring story. Never mind.
No. I want to. On Arrested, were you involved with the writing process or like what? How?
Nope. No. Occasionally Mitch would say like, oh, you know, if you want to help out or, but there just wasn't. That wasn't really the protocol, and everybody assumed it was highly improvised, and it wasn't. It was so tightly written. In the beginning, I'd say the pilot and the first, I don't know, the beginning of the first year, there was more improvisation, but really not a whole lot of room for it because, I mean, we got long scripts. That show, by the time you're cutting everything out, it's literally 21 and a half minutes per half hour. That's on screen, and we were getting, 44-page scripts.
Wow. Oh, shit.
Yeah. And it's, so a lot of stuff that you would even shoot that was scripted wouldn't make it in, So we kind of quickly learned to not riff so much. But it's a testament to the quality of the writing that people thought it was,
Yeah.
And there was some in the beginning, a very beginning, but really not a lot after that.
I wouldn't have thought that show was that heavily improvised just because so many tangential things became that would pay off later on or, become major storylines.
Yeah, later on, definitely. But in the beginning, we got that a lot. I mean, I know Will did. I know Jason did. Like, people just sort of had this, just assumption. I'm not sure why, but
well, because you guys are fun. You're comedian, like you're funny people, and they probably just assume like
and just the docu-camera style. You know,
yeah, true. That probably had something to do with it too. Yeah.
Is there any further news about the? I'm sure everyone's asking you about the movie, which you're probably sick of hearing about. But
I no further news from the point. Whatever it was, I think in August.
Yeah, where Mitch said something.
Yeah, and nothing. I'll see Mitch. I'll see Mitch and Will on Saturday, and I can find out if there's anything more going on. But I have not heard anything. But I mean, there was a potential plan, a schedule, kind of a vague sense of when we'd be doing it, which was summer of 2012. So, you know, if that's good to go, then. And I know everybody, to a person, everybody was like, yeah, we're in. Let's do it.
Great.
Yeah. A lot of it, I think, is, unfortunately, it's just the business of this business, is it's the studios talking amongst themselves, because the plan is, it's just boring business stuff. But you know how, like, the film department talks to the TV department, they're completely separate from this division of this
Oh, yeah,
studio.
The worst. And then each one of those places has a business affairs person, and then they start talking, and then it gets to, when it gets to,
like,
the lawyers,
it's a
and it's just like,
contest,
what the
and,
fuck?
You know, everybody wants their, not even, like, financially, their claim and their stake, but kind of their, like, this is our thing, you know.
Hey, but you're not doing anything with it!
So it unfortunately, there's a bit of that to it, I think, you know.
But in the interim, the increasingly important decisions of Todd Margaret is on IFC in the States.
Great show.
Is there the new season premiering?
The new season, which will be the last season, it ends with this as it was always meant to. You know, it's a story that's told over 14 days, and I believe January 6th is when series 2 premieres, which literally picks up this second after when I close the door at the end of series 1, the last episode. It takes up from that
That's
exact
awesome.
Second. And but IFC put together this this recap special because it's so plot heavy and intricate, and so there's going to be like this recap thing that's played up to the I don't know when they'll start airing that, but up to the beginning of series 2, and I think they're going to do like a marathon leading up into the next episode.
Cool.
But it basically goes back and catches you up and also shows you some of the clues that are there in the first series as to what's really happening, and a number of people, and I kind of, I wish it wasn't the case, but it was the case, and I can't necessarily blame them, but we lost a lot of people who tuned in for the first two episodes, who went like, what? This isn't that funny. I don't get it. You know, and the first couple episodes are, you know, who didn't realize it was serialized, and I couldn't promote the show by going like, there's a lot of secrets, and watch that. And, you know, you don't want people to go into a show like that. You want them to discover these things. And
right. And
people stuck with the show. Definitely, like, around episode 4, definitely by 5 and 6, were like, you know, you could tell, like, oh, wait a minute. Wait a second. I get it. This guy is, you know, and seeing it more as this kind of mystery or story or whatever.
So then I would just say to people that if you haven't watched the show yet, just, you know, get the first season and glide into series 2.
Oh, do not watch series 2 without watching series 1. It'd be stupid. You
but I mean,
know
but now, but now that
on.
People know, I think the benefit of the way people consume things now is that rather than having to wait and try to they can just watch everything at once and just kind of get the instant.
Well, the DVD of series 1, which has tons of shit on it. I mean, tons and tons of extra stuff, and definitely we did commentary both in England and in the States with various people, and you know, we point out, like, watch, here's a clue, and here are the inside jokes that won't pay off until episode 7 and stuff like that. But that comes out on December 27th.
Okay.
So series 1 DVD, and that will really catch you up to, as well as the IFC recap, but that's a half hour of,
that's perfect,
in a nutshell, what you need to know to get. But I would not recommend watching series two without watching.
That's perfect, because a week and a half later, then series two starts, and then people will be perfectly primed. Yeah. Cool. Well, Cross, thanks for coming in, man. It's good to see you.
Hey, Hardwick, no problem.
I haven't seen you in years. I feel like it's been years.
Well, it has. I don't live here anymore.
I know, but I come to New York a lot. But
I was in London for the last 2 years.
Ah, shit. See, there's that.
Out of excuses.
Fuck.
But I got to say, I'm impressed by your memory. You're going way back with these details.
Stuff sticks in there.
These hazy, drunken nights.
Stuff sticks in there. They were very important times to me because, I mean, I always... You know, I always looked up to you and that group as sort of like, that's, you know, that's what I want to do. And, you know, it was very...
And God bless you, you went and did it.
Well, I always feel like, but I'm not really doing the... I mean, when I make the comparison of like senior class, sophomore, freshman class, like that's how I've always felt.
You never catch up.
No, but those guys are, but Dave's doing that. Yeah. And, you know, like those guys and Zach's doing this, you know, and it just always feels like, but not with any sense of anger, like, God damn it, just like, but those guys are really what it's all about.
So what we should basically do is instead of having a class reunion, say, class of 1992, we should just have a class reunion of class of 91 through 96.
The class of 90s.
Yeah, class of beginning 90s.
We'll do a class of 90s.
It's going to be an awesome party.
I can't wait.
I'll see if the Feelies can
play. I'll get the squiggles.
All right.
You guys.
Feelies.
Enjoy your burrito, Jonah Ray.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that is simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to HOVER.com/Nerdist.